Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends.
And Brian Brushwood will be joining us, I think, in the middle of the show as he puts out a brush fire. And then we have Mr. Bryce Castillo, our extraordinary producer.
Hi, everybody. I'm glad to be back on the show.
Gentlemen, there's a lot of interesting things going on here. It's very, very, very – I don't know where to begin. Well, there is news about the EM drive. Remember the EM drive? That's like that if you put this sort of special, you know, microwave emitter inside of a special cone-shaped thing, that maybe this thing violates the laws of physics as we understand them.
Sure, yeah.
There's a difference between breaking the laws of the universe and breaking the laws of the universe as we understand them. You know, I have to make that exception. So yeah. It's been this theoretical mechanism that if true, would be big, very, very big if true.
So as I remember the initial stories, for space travel, this would be gigantic because it would be a propulsion without the kind of fuel resources that you would otherwise normally need. That just makes things a million and a half times easier to get from one place to another. And as I remember it being left, this is something that many people were skeptical of, but had yet to be unproven as people continued to test test the tech.
Mm-hmm. So it was there was some research, some laboratory experiments that showed that something was going on that was interesting, and that's why other people pursued it. It wasn't just, hey, I got a crazy theory. Would it be neat if this is true? It was, hey, we've got this thing, and we've built it, and we're seeing some interesting effects. We can't quite explain it. And some people explain it within conventional physics, say, no, there's this Mach effect. There's other things that could be going on here. So a German group of researchers decided, you know what, we're going to do this. We're going to build our own. From the ground up, we're going to follow the exact specifications for how people think this thing should work. Designed it, went to use, let's call it, German tolerances on things and the level of precision and whatnot. Turn this thing on, and they got movement. They got movement, but they also had an explanation. So they have this thing. They turn it on, and all of a sudden it starts to move in one direction. They're like, huh. Let's switch some of the parts around and see if it still moves in the same direction. Because if it's supposed to go this way when everything's facing this way, but you switch, you know, the cavitation chamber around the opposite direction and it still moves that way, something else is going on. And that's what happened. Mm. And they said, well, let's increase the amount of energy going in there. Does it move faster? No. I'm like, well, what's going on here? And they came up with a theory, and it seems to be they've narrowed it down to what's really going on. And that is that it's an electromagnetic field reacting against the Earth's electromagnetic field. That it's basically traditionally explained by, you know, no, physics still works as we understand it.
So instead of the machine generating movement itself, it was, what, magnetizing itself and moving based on the pole of the Earth?
Well, yeah, because Earth has, you know, the weak magnetic fields, and it was just sort of pushing against that.
Yeah.
And so, which you could do. I mean, that's a thing that you could design an experiment in a laboratory to try to do that. And so it's not a revolutionary form of technology. It's a very inefficient way to try to, you know, move something there as they understand it. And it kind of fits into like what that's one of the expectations people had for is like it might just be repelling off the magnetic field of the Earth. And the goal of this is something works in a vacuum of space where there's but actually the magnetic fields like throughout, like, you know, the solar system has one, the galaxy has one, there's incredible amount of background, you know, magnetic fields and stuff, but extremely negligible. So it's not really an effective means to utilize that because it's not working out the effect we wanted.
Outside of the vacuum of space, well, even in space, this would be an issue, but are there locations on Earth where you could test something like this without that background magnetism? Is that even
you
possible?
You can shield it, but also what you can do is, if you know, to determine if it is that or not, you know, you can change the direction of which the equipment is facing. You know, that alone will tell you, you know, what it's doing in relation to magnetic fields.
Right. And you mentioned they did that, and it still ended up going the same direction.
They switched parts around of it, and they said, yeah, no, it's just a magnetic field. It's just sort of like, move like a compass needle. You know, compass needle is, you know, in some forms, kind of a basic sort of EM field. Mm-hmm.
Is this the last that we hear about the M drive?
I think the diehards are people who really want there to be something are going to pick apart the experiment and say that, well, you know, they did it do it the way we did it. But I think that I'm always for other people replicating things. That's one of the problems. And this gets to one of the biggest problems in science. And that has been the reproducibility. And that is or the replication of other experiments. There was a big study done a couple years ago where they took a ton of experiments in like psychology, and they said, let's go replicate all these experiments and let's see what our results show. And they got results that were nowhere near as dramatic or nowhere near as, you know, positive as what was shown in a significant number of studies, which implied that, well, we tested some of the biggest studies out there and we found out that we couldn't replicate the same, you know, impact they had. And some of this was random sampling of studies, what have you. We found this, that a lot of research gets published has exaggerated, you know, results. And there are a lot of ways you can exaggerate something. And I came across this when I worked for the James Randi Foundation. And Justin, you worked there too, is, you know, you'd counter people who claimed ESP was real. And you'd see some people who might kind of try to do their own little study about this thing. And you'd see there was this selection bias. They might select a data set where it showed there was an effect, but they would ignore the ones that weren't. And this wasn't something that was only in parapsychology. And this wasn't something that was done necessarily consciously. You know, if you're a researcher trying to measure an effect of, like, you know, does a certain species more prone towards, you know, having a gene that relates to being able to eat some sort of food, and you really think this is a solid theory, and you have a bunch of data sets and it's more prevalent in one data set than another, and you're convinced the theory is right, you will psychologically, we need to get rid of those other data sets because my other lab assistant worked on that. We think there was something polluted or some element was introduced to that, so we can discount that. We'll rule that out. We'll get rid of this other data set. This control is probably pretty good. Scientists are people. Science moves forward. You know, if you're a scientist, you know, you want your research to generally get positive results. We talk about the idea that, science rewards failure, not science as it's done right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, as an ideal, it should, right? Because every study is worthwhile, even if it's proving that you're not doing it.
Yeah. And the problem you get into, like, if I'm going to go for funding, let's say I want to fund some study because I think that there's some psychological effect maybe isn't as pronounced, and I want to go test this sort of thing because I'm known to question this thing. A good chance one of the people on the committee, one of the people they're going to consult is somebody who's doing this, did this research 20 years ago, or somebody who was one of the pioneers in this field.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be inclined to say, yeah, fund this guy. Find out, prove me wrong. You know, that would be the noble scientific ideal that we want, but that is really not what happens. And you find that there is the average age of people who are the senior paper writers has gone up. There's a lot of evident bias we find within the way it's done. Science is a process, of course, is amazing. It's the best thing ever happened to us. Science is we execute it, or science is how we perform the process. You know, it's just as problematic as ever because it's people.
Yeah. You know, it is weird, right? Because it's something that I found with journalism that, you know, reporters who spend their entire days and I think do amazing, important work going into awkward situations where they are convincing strangers that they need to open up their lives and open up on secrets and things that could affect their livelihood, economically, sometimes emotionally, almost certainly, and their personal reputation, are very bad at being on the other end of that. Like they have all, and this is anecdotally, this is just my personal observations, but when you start to look into somebody else, there is, instead of saying, no, I want to set the example of how I would love if sources treated me when I come to them, and I'm going to fully open up and I'm going to be more transparent than I would. It's very often the opposite. And it's like, why are you doing this to me? Like all the things that you would that you would hate to find if you were just trying to get a source on an important story. And I think science, I think there's a human sort of element to that, that, you know, specifically in something that is a slower, more costly cycle like research is, and there's fewer places where you can ply your trade as a scientist, that there's unfortunately a lot of that very human protect your own, protect, you know, your life to the detriment of the larger knowledge base.
Now, one of our commenters, Dan Wally, says capitalism and science aren't always compatible. Maybe, Dan, it's even worse in socialist and communist countries. That's the, if you look at the history of what happened there, you know, of Lysenko and Lamarckism and the idea that once the state says this is the way something is, whatever, it's human nature and objectivity. Those are the problems. And of course, humans in our human nature, we're going to have that forever. We have to build ways to correct for that. And I would argue that in a free society or free market society, you have a much better chance of getting to the truth eventually, because if somebody disagrees with it in a state one or state system, the people in charge, and there's numerous examples of things, scientific developments that have held back because of the state, because no, we've decided this is not worth funding anymore. The guy in charge of this department has said so. Soviet agriculture cratered because of one guy who said, no, this is the way things work. In our, the energy department here, we've been following for the last 40 years, 50 years, one pathway towards fusion, which is the tokamak reactor design. And there are a number of people say, no, this isn't way, the way to do it. But the people in charge at the state level, like, hey, no, we've been doing this for years. We know we're going to get this right. They don't want to be proven wrong and find out they spent the last 35 years wasting everybody else's money. So I would say it's human nature. And that's the way is you want to figure out how do you have a system that says accounts for that. And I think now having a study that went back, and I think Bryce pulled it up, they went back, they tried to reproduce 100 studies, getting in this healthy attitude of like, no, we're going to challenge these things, prepare to be challenged. And I think that will make scientists want to raise the bar. More competition, more people trying to replicate this, more people trying to go after to find out if this is real or not.
So what is there a solution to this? There are always going to be humans at the helm. Is it an oversight issue?
Maybe. I would say part of it is the likelihood of funding the studies that challenge older studies and figuring out a way to incentivize that. And the other side is just having there be a healthy scientific community wherein, look, that nobody gets a championship belt, right? Like, you know, every great discovery should be picked apart and re-verified a million times, and it should be the strength of its, you know, robustness of how well it can withstand peer review and challenges that makes it an important finding, not the discovery itself.
One of the problems you have, too, is that there is a tremendous amount of studies that are published and the data sets are not made available. That's been a big controversy in a lot of environmental stuff relating to climate change, a lot of stuff that's influencing policy. And other people say, can we look at the data and the scientists involved? Like, no, it's too complicated for you to get to it, whatever. And it's not endemic to them. I have friends that are lab researchers that their data spread across a bunch of different formats, a bunch of different things. If they wanted to make it accessible to somebody else, it's problematic. When they go to a journal thing, they put the stuff in there. Often nobody even opens up the spreadsheets. They just say, oh, okay, this must be really, you know, there. So, you know, the solution is that, you know, the question is who's going to fund these studies. It's the same way we're doing it now, but let's encourage an environment of being more critical. Well, let's take a look at who's deciding how these things, the makeup of the people who decide who gets this funding. That's one of the things that can be disconcerting when you look at like how the National Science Foundation funding works. There is tons of risk aversion. They're less likely to fund things that might have a negative result. They want to fund something that's going to have a positive result. So if I bring something to them, it's got to be something much more closer to the orthodoxy, and it might have to be something that's a little bit too much, you know, closer to this. So, you know, I think there is funding. There's a lot of opportunities to get this thing out there, but let's create – there is an increasing climate. There is actually going back and testing other studies, and it's scientists saying, if I attack your study, I'm not attacking science. I want to make sure that we're all trying to hold ourselves to a higher standard.
So then it's on the peer review level that we can fortify this on in general.
Yeah, and I think as scientists themselves, you know, when you publish, make your data more widely available. And I have a problem with some of these, you know, some of these for-profit, you know, science journals that, you know, where you choose to publish can have an effect. People will publish out of, I'm going to publish here because it's prestigious. Like, great, only a small number of people are going to read this, mm-hmm. and nobody gets access to your data if you do this there. Now, I understand you. It's like, I want to have that that journal on my paper because it gives me prestige. It's like, yeah, but you're not helping science, and that's mm-hmm. a choice to be made, and I think that's something we have to weigh. I think Archive, which is, you know, Archive with an X, is a really cool thing that makes things widely available. There's a lot of really cool up-and-coming journals because guess what? Science knows about this problem. There are a lot of scientists really trying to fight this thing, combat with it. And there are a lot of really good solutions out there. So,
yeah.
Huh. You know, but being aware helps.
Yeah. Well, you know what you should also be aware of?
Yeah. And that's our Patreon.
That's right.
We got a Patreon here, folks. If you want to make sure that the number one science and weird topics podcast is here for you in your life each and every week, well, then head on over to weirdthings.com. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
That's right.
That is where you can support our show. And not only do you get the satisfaction, you also get our After Things podcast where we pivot a little bit and take our unique banter and talk about how you can continue to achieve your goals in creativity and in business and everything in between. Yeah. So go ahead and check it out. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
So last week, Elon Musk danced up the 405 over to a temple that's right in this sort of a very difficult to get to place when traffic is pretty busy, and did a live chat or live discussion with the co-founder or the guy who runs the Boring company for him. Davidson, let me pull up his name, make sure I get that right. Mm-hmm. And they talked about Hyperloop and
Nick Bolton.
Or rather the Loop and then Hyperloop and their whole plan to start building tunnels. Any of you guys catch this?
The only thing that I caught, aside from a few headlines, was you saying that you had an ability to go there and didn't because you were too embarrassed that you would fanboy out in front of Elon Musk.
Yeah, Steve Davis is the guy who he did this speech with, who I've heard his name come up before, but this is the first time I actually got to see Steve Davis talk. Hmm. He's the project leader for it. So let me back up. For those, you know, Boring Company, it started off like many things that people go like, wait, is this a joke? And then Elon Musk says, nope, I'm serious. Now it's a fact. And which sometimes you don't know if Elon Musk's like, oh, how dare you call it a joke? Well, I'll make it real. And he'd been talking for years about tunnels. Like, why don't we have more tunnels? And if you live in LA, you get this because you're trying to get from, let's say, south part of Los Angeles to the north part, and traffic is really, really bad. And you're on a highway that there are buildings on either type of side of the highway. There's no room to build more highway, and there's cars everywhere. And if you live in LA and you want to stay in LA and you want to get from point to point, you're like, there's got to be a better way. A week ago, Uber showed us like, hey, we're going to introduce flying cars, and they use LA as an example. This is how quickly we can get you from point A to point B, and you know, LA using flying cars. Which you're like, first, like, oh, that sounds awesome, and then you're like, how awesome would it be with 10,000 helicopters overhead at once, like?
It would be intimidating.
Less cool. I think we can all settle on the idea that it'd be less cool than you might think.
It's cool if you're the one person in the flying car. You know, that's when it's cool. But when you try to scale that, that's the issue. So Elon Musk has talked about, hey, you know, there's this really cool old idea called tunnels. Tunnels apparently are a way to get from point A to point B. Yeah. He talks about the problem you have in a city is we go into a building, which is a 3D structure. Your people are stacked up on top of each other, and then they've got to get to some other location at the end of the day. They want to go home. Everybody empties this 3D structure, then enters 2D space at the same time as everybody else, which is why you have traffic, because you have a heck of a lot of people here, there, then now we all need to go. I'm like, oh, wait, this 2D space can't handle it.
Going from building to road, sure.
Yeah, exactly. The beauty of tunnels, and this is one of these things that people, because you have people bring up like induced demand and these other things like, oh, you can't solve this problem. It's like, no, that's induced demand means you've been under meeting the amount of demand there is, and you have a system that doesn't scale well to meet it. tunnels is, let's say we build a tunnel from, you know, point A to point B. Let's say we build a tunnel from, you know, a big one, or, you know, from, you know, LA to San Francisco. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know what? We've reached capacity. You know, the beautiful thing is we'll build another tunnel below that tunnel 10 feet deeper. And we don't have to shut off the original tunnel. Now we've added another tunnel. Ah, but we reached capacity there. Great. We build another tunnel. Roads, every time you want to expand a road, you're like, ah, you know, this row of buildings here and everybody lives here or whatever. Like, yeah, we got to evict you. It's easier now because of the Kelo Act. You know, we've decided that you don't really own anything. But that's problematic, where tunnels allow you to build in three-dimensional space. You can keep adding capacity by going deeper or sideways or whatever. And that's the beauty of a tunnel. The problem is you can agree, like, yeah, we have, if you just keep building under the tunnel, and these tunnels would be built under existing roads, so it's not like you have to worry about, you know, your house having a tunnel going, you know, tunnel going under it. Mm-hmm. The problem with tunnels is tunnels are expensive. Tunnels are expensive to build. You know, you need big machines to do this. You've got to remove all this dirt and fill. You've got to put reinforcements in there, and they have a big impact to everybody around you. One of the ways they dig tunnels traditionally was, you know, you just dig a trench and then you cover it over. A lot of the subways in New York, that's how they dug them, because it's the cheapest way to do it. But that's disruptive. So Elon, being Elon, was like, huh, you know, I don't know if you heard my work in rockets. You know, I have to do a little bit there. And, you know, let me remind you, I make them land now. And then he's like, because he's got some of the best engineers in the world. He's like, could we apply these engineers to tunneling? And people are like, well, why hasn't somebody done it before? Often, you know, it's a great question. You need to find out, nobody's bothered to put the money or resources into it. In rockets, nobody tried to make rockets reusable, because they figured out there's only X number of companies willing to launch stuff, or governments willing to launch stuff every year. There's a great article with this very bitter article with the head of Ariane, which is the company, the European agency that builds rockets there. It's an amazing company, but just very bitter about SpaceX. And like, well, if we lower the cost of the rockets, then what am I supposed to do to tell my people who build my rockets? See you next year. And you're like, that's not the right answer if you're explaining why things aren't cheaper. So anyhow, if you can make something cheaper, then maybe that would be better. And so that's what Elon's been trying to do with the boring companies. It's, can we make these tunneling machines faster, and can we make it cheaper? Because if we can do that, we could put a bunch of smaller electric vehicles in there, not big long trains like subways, but small little minibus electric vehicles, and we could get you anywhere in LA in 15 minutes for a buck.
Yeah.
That's the kind of interesting thing, because there's certainly, as part of the Silicon Valley kind of backlash that we have seen develop over the last few years, there's always the kind of snide, you know, every 6 months, one of these brilliant egghead CEO god kings stumble upon the brilliant idea of a bus or a subway or something. And it's like, you can certainly appreciate kind of where somebody is coming from on that. But the idea here is like, all right, yeah, but also, what if we could make that idea better? Like, what if we could make it more scalable? What if we could make it something that was, you know, dare I say it, if not profitable, something that you could at least expect, you know, would not be a tremendous burden that would go neglected, like so many of the great public transit infrastructures in New York and out here in the Bay Area are, I mean, these things are falling apart. They were not built to what they were initially supposed to be, and they are disintegrating. So it's like, okay, well, I think this field deserves a second look. If somebody can make things cheaper, safer, and more upgradable,
then and then one of the key things there is they're privately funding it, where we have a $50 billion high-speed rail project in California, and as people happy to point out, it will neither be, you know, it's not going to be high speed. It's going to be the most expensive rail project ever per mile and the slowest high speed rail project ever. And it's, you know, trying to build it, they're going to build it from nowhere to nowhere right now, because trying to get it into cities and stuff is problematic. And, you know, it's going to cost $50 to $60 billion, and it's going to cost, if this thing were to be finished, well over that. And it's become a jobs project, and nobody wants, people involved don't want to kill it, because it, you know, even if they nothing ever productive happens with it, their people will be like, well, at least we'll employ people. And there are other people going like, yeah, but imagine if we had those people building something like loops, you know, and then building the hyperloop, which, you know, the loop, you'd go up to 170 miles an hour. And then the hyperloop, if you use that, which I'm less skeptical now, you know, seeing the amount of enthusiasm there's been for that, you know, where you go 700 miles an hour and you have a system of loops and hyperloops, if we, that would be kind of cool. And if it wants to be privately funded, all the better.
You mentioned, you know, at this, I don't know, this presentation or whatever, that the rides would be a dollar. What's the status of the current tunnel that he's building now?
So what he's doing,
Price has a dollar, and he'd like to get somewhere in LA when we go there for the live show.
So they have a tunnel that runs from, they're working on one that runs from the parking lot in front of SpaceX. Which I have a photo of me standing in front of that when they first started. When they was, you could just look in there and see this hole in the ground. I took a photo there, and my friend's like, "Why are you taking a photo?" I'm like, "Do you know what this is?" Like, "No, like, it's the tunnel. It's the tunnel, you know?" I'm like, "Okay, weirdo." That one is going to be like a 2-mile tunnel, a test tunnel. So they're building a test tunnel, right, which they think they're getting near to completion. The goal is once they finish the test tunnel, they're going to put like a car or system that goes on it. And he says that we're going to invite the public to come ride on it. He says it's not going to be a thing we're going to charge. It's not a thing to compete with any transportation systems there. He says we'll invite people to ride on it because I think they want to find out like what works, you know, what's comfortable, you know, how fast can we move, get people on and off this thing? What's the people's reaction?
Yeah.
And it's a great, you know, way to move along. And they've tried to make it very clear, like, we don't have all the answers right now. We have an idea what we want to do. We know there's a problem. Traffic is a problem around the world. Transportation is a thing that could be improved upon. We think taking this old tech tunneling that people are like, nah, we know everything we know about tunnels. Really? Do we? Do we know everything about building them? Do we? Or could we improve there? Let's spend, because it's been a neglected area. You know, there's only like one or two colleges in the United States that even have courses that really teach you about tunneling and stuff at a big level. So let's approach that. So if somebody says tunnels and earthquakes, that's why there's no subways in Japan at all. Tunnels
or,
are the safest
or
place.
In the Bay Area. I mean, like, we just had a 3.8 magnitude in Oakland. Like, you know, it's built to withstand. I mean, like, the idea that earthquakes happen are not surprised.
Tunnels are the safest place to be in an earthquake. Tunnels are the safest place to be in an earthquake because it's like on the ocean. You know, do you want to be above the waves when it's getting rocky, or do you want to be below? And so earthquakes are surface effects. So in places like Mexico City, when they have earthquakes, whatever, they use the tunnels as evacuation places. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
This is not the issue.
Also, you know, the best place that you can be as a tunnel is if Germany is bombing your city.
Fun fact, it's true.
That's I heard that somewhere in a book.
It's on a Bazooka Joe comic strip, I think. So what did Elon say during this little Q&A? Is there any new news on the boring company front?
The news is that they have a partnership with the LA Metro, so the Los Angeles Metro, so to say that we're going to work together in conjunction with them to make sure that our plans work together. You know, you're LA, Los Angeles, and city planners know that here's the problem. You're a city, you know that you're looking at where you are now and you're not meeting demand, and you're saying 10, 15, 20 years from now, we're going to have so much more demand for infrastructure. If you have somebody that comes along and says, hey, I have a solution, I'm not going to ask you for any money. I'm going to say, you know, when we need to get permits or processes, we'll do our due diligence, but don't make us spend 15 years to find out that we can't dig a 100-foot test tunnel, and that's the problem. And the problem is that on one hand, you don't want to give, you know, a company, an agency, or anybody like this free rein to do whatever they want and then find out that, like, no, you are affecting our water table. Oh, this is problematic. And then nobody's asking for that because that would be bad, you know. But you want to make sure there's a right amount of checks and balances. But one of the things that happens, though, is, like, you know, it took forever to be able to get to move, have like the LA subway as it is, go out to West Side to go down to Santa Monica there, because the people there didn't want it. They didn't want it. They didn't, because you had a very wealthy community there, did not want to have a fast conduit from there. Now, they would argue publicly totally different reasons. They would bring up all these other reasons. But when you talk to people on a private level, it was like they have cars, they have money, they don't want people who don't have this money or whatever to come to their area. You know, and they looked at just this a conduit to bad neighborhoods is the way it was perceived. Nobody would ever say that publicly. Privately, that was the reason. And they would use every reason in the world they could to stop it. Environmental, all these sort of excuses to stop this. And then you have people who are, you know, you have people who, you know, I think maybe have legitimate environmental concerns that feel like they're not being addressed. I think they are, but you have people who feel like, well, maybe we don't know the impact. Then you have people who are uneasy with a private company getting that involved in public transit. You have people too. You have people who are like, no, we need to ride bicycles and stuff and that. And, you know, people who have different viewpoints on how people should do this. There are people who don't like the idea of individual personal transport. You know, no, we want bigger trains. Why? Like, you know, so there's a lot of competing interests for what people think everybody else should have access to. So,
which is ultimately, you know, the problem, right? Is that everybody has a different idea when you're talking about collective money.
Yeah, and that the problem is that the traditional answer to it, like in many projects, if stadium projects, which I think are generally dumb ideas, or mass transit projects, the answer ends up being we put so much money into the project, everybody gets paid off and makes money.
Yeah.
You know.
And so between the jobs and the construction and all the contractors, like that this will be a good enough thing for enough people that even if it doesn't do what we think it's what we promise it's going to do, at least a bunch of people got paid.
Yeah. So a question comes up, a great question. Has Boring done any study to see if these tunnels could have issues with ground erosion, like mining or fracking? Certainly they have to figure out what will these specific tunnels do. And when you're talking one or two tunnels or five tunnels, you're going to have a minimal impact because it's like building large sewer lines or what have you there, or subway lines. When you get into the massive amounts of underground removal of materials like you do in mining, where you take a mountain and you mine out, you know, 20 or 30% of its interior, you do have issues like there. Fracking, where you have water, you can affect the water table and you start, you know, bringing out sediment and stuff and destabilizing that and creating sinkholes and stuff. Those are real issues that have to be addressed. Some of those have been way overstated. There's been a lot of exaggerated things in fracking, which has made it problematic to figure out what's really a problem, what's not a problem. You know, they take a place that already had, you know, natural gas in the water supply and like, oh, look, there's natural gas after fracking. No, the reason they fracked there is because that was there. But then real problems of, you know, overpumping or making mistakes or using slurries and stuff that cause problems. So, mm-hmm. You know. It's yes, I'm sure that there are parts of these trying to look into, trying to figure out, you know, to what degree, how many of these you're talking, you know, the tunneling is something that's a lot of research into that, how much you remove out of an area versus, you know, how it affects the surrounding areas. So that's part of it. Part of their studies are saying this is what happens. And one of the things they talk about, though, is that when they tunnel, you will not be able to detect them from the surface. They said there's no instrument in the world to be able to detect that they were down there digging because there's this sort of property with the further down a tunnel is for every like tunnel diameter, two tunnel diameters, the amount of any energy you give off getting absorbed by the surrounding soil, it's law of inverse squares. So by the time you get to the surface, you can't even – somebody walking past a sensor gives off way more impact than that.
So I have one more question about the Boring Company. I know when they originally sent out or put out that concept video, it was, you can drive your car into it. Am I remembering right that they are scaling back the idea of driving your car onto the system?
So that's a good catch, Bryce. So when they first showed the video for this, they showed public transportation vehicles and cars. They showed people using, you know, electric cars in there, you know, in some autopilot mode. And that got a huge backlash because all of a sudden, they're building a secret road for the rich. Well, I mean, the best way to build a thing, let me tell you how rich people like to build things. They like to get poor people to pay for them, which means you get them to use it. So, you know, there's, you know, like, you know, you could argue an HOV lane that lets you use electric vehicles for a number of years was a rich person luxury because who could afford an electric car? It was rich people, you know, but people like, no, those things are great.
So that's early concept video, we're watching a Tesla go into this tunnel.
But when you watch the tunnel, and it gets put on an electric skate, it gets put on a skate, right? So the idea is cars could go into these tunnels, so anybody's car could get put on there. Now, when you talk about transportation and mass transit, you know, people who are very active in that hate cars, hate cars. They hate the ideas of this personal transportation vehicle that efficiently takes you from point A to point B in a time frame you want. But they also show these small little clear plastic margarine dish buses or whatever. Which we're probably using, you know, Tesla Model 3 engines anyway, or Model X.
They look like standing buses, almost like short standing squat buses.
Yeah, kind of like you'd see at like an airport shuttle. So they show these too. But people sort of fixated on the cars there. They fixated on the cars. And so Elon was trying to say, listen, like, it's not about cars or minibuses. It's about getting a person from point A to point B fast, really, really fast, and not have to go to a subway station that is across town. Like, I live in LA. People are like, you'd ever take the subway? I'm like, by the time I get from here to the nearest subway station, I would be wherever I wanted to be in my car. Mm-hmm. And the answer is not putting a subway station at the end of my block, because a subway station takes up a block. And it's a great answer for some places that have been built on top of those infrastructure. But for suburb, when you get to below a certain population density, it is inefficient. This is a solution where it is so cheap in theory, and we'll find out if they make it, to sort of put – you could put one of these at the end of a block. If you built a new neighborhood community, you could put one of these at the end of everybody's driveway, which would be the goal. If you're a developer – and here's the thing to think about this. If you have a much cheaper way to build these tunnels, if you can build these tunnels much more inexpensively and maybe even cheaper than roads to some extent, or the cost of a road, whatever, if you want to do a housing development 30 miles away from Austin, or 30 miles away from LA, or 30 miles away from Oakland, and you build a couple of these tunnels in there, and you can tell people like, hey, we can take you from your house to the city center in 10 minutes. That's incredibly attractive.
Yeah,
you know, it's incredibly attractive. It lowers housing prices. It gets us the ability to be able to work much further away. It lowers the density of the cities. It lowers traffic. It has a big impact. And I think that's the future we're getting towards, is it's not just to alleviate traffic in LA. It's also to solve the housing problem. You know, we have so many housing prices are high in the Bay Area and LA. So a lot of people got to work here. There's not a lot of places to live here, and expensively. But if you could get here much more quickly via a 10-minute little magic little tunnel, changes everything.
Yeah. Is there any – I know that the one metric in a very Elon Muskian way that they made about the Boring Company was trying to get faster than – what was it, his kid's pet snail?
Gary the Snail. So what they did is they said – they talk about how slow tunneling machines are, boring machines are. And they use an example. They talk about – they have this the snail, Gary, and they talk about how fast a snail moves. And like you know, the boring machine right now is like 10 times slower than a snail, something like that, like 10 times slower than a snail. Mm-hmm. And their goal was, we want to make a tunneling machine beat Gary the Snail. If we can beat Gary the Snail, or go even faster, says, you know, we could, you know, it would be dramatically change things. And trying to do that, one, it's improving the speed of the drill head, but also they started talking about, it's worth watching the presentation where they get into, here are the problems of trying to tunnel. You have the drill head, right? And then you have all of the dirt coming out the back of it, all that dirt. You've got to move all that dirt out of the tunnel. And if you're a couple miles into a tunnel, that's a couple miles you got to transport the dirt. Then you've got to move that dirt from the tunnel site to somewhere else, which traditionally you put on a ton of trucks and you cause a disruption. One of his solutions, and you pay somebody, and it's an expense to haul it away. You pay someone to haul it away. And he's found out that they said, you know, we could make bricks. We might be able to charge 10 cents a brick by using a little bit of concrete additive in the rock sediment we pull from here. And they said we plan on selling bricks. It's one of the things we want to do, is we want to take that rock that we're basically pulling out of there, turn it into bricks, you know, these you know, Boring Company bricks, mm-hmm. sell them to construction. So that's one way they're trying to solve the problem of getting – they have a conveyor system. They took a Model 3 engine and they put it with a big, you know, conveyor, put a Model 3 with a bunch of, you know, containers to move the sediment out of the slurry or whatever, out of the tunnel back out. That was step one. This is, we found a faster way to get rid of the material. Step two, powering the drill. These drills are electric, and they either the runoff of diesel, which means you've got tremendous amounts of diesel fumes that you then have to vent, or they're electric, which means you have a cable that's powering them. Now, this is not a standard sort of power cable like you see in a house. This is huge, thick copper, because that drill head is tremendously powerful, and those things weigh tons, the amount of cabling you need. So they said, well, why don't we take some Tesla power packs or some Tesla power walls, put them on another cart, and treat it like a cordless electric drill. And we pull the power pack up, charge it, or have it, you know, run the drill. When it's depleted, we pull it away, put another one in. So they're doing things like this to try to improve it, because there's just been, well, this is just the way we do it. And their mentality is, sometimes it's the best way to do it. And people thought about, the Romans figured out this is the best way to do it. Sometimes there's a better way.
So, all right. So when you say it's not as fast as Gary the Snail, it's not necessarily that the drill can't go as fast. It's like everything that goes on around it of, venting and getting rid of the material and stuff like that. Just the entire process is slower than a snail.
You do need to make the drill go faster, but from an engineering point of view, the engineers can say, well, you know, we'll give it, you know, 10 times the torque or whatever. Then as far as the materials we're using on the drill heads, and there's some really cool, they're like materials now that like, part of what's cool about having a bunch of space, and that's largely this is a bunch of SpaceX engineers work on this, is that, you know, there's a lot of new materials that are being used in aerospace that have not made their way outside of there. You have, you know, metals like Inconel and things like that that nobody's putting into tunneling machines that might, you know, have a dramatic impact on that. So, but it's a lot of things. It's the power, it's the moving the slurry, it is the speed of the drill head to a part, but all these sort of things create these bottlenecks.
And so these issues, although solvable, are not something that people have tried to innovate on, because what's the point? We still have to do all these other things anyway. So, who cares?
Yeah, because it's kind of like in the rocket industry. You know, the rocket, there was an article interview with the guy who's head of Ariane, which is the European company that builds some amazing tech. And they're like, well, how do you feel about SpaceX? And first he says, oh, well, you know, the government overpays them for the launches, so it pays for the private launches, which is not really true. But and then they're like, well, what about reusability? He's like, what's the advantage of reusability? And it comes down to, and this is what I just said earlier, is he's like, what am I supposed to do with the people I pay to build my rockets? If we're reusing rockets, then we don't need them to build rockets. And so he doesn't understand, or he doesn't grasp it. If you build reusable rockets and you lower the cost of getting things into space, more people want to get things into space, you know, space. And, you know, he said like, well, for us to do reusable, we need to be doing like 30 launches a year. Well, that's what SpaceX is heading towards. They're lowering that cost. And now you're getting companies and countries that are putting up satellites that could not afford them before. And it's not a dramatic reduction in cost, because SpaceX still has tons of sunk costs in research and R&D, what they're trying to do. So the actual cost for the rocket itself versus what they're trying to pay off for the R&D, you know, it's different. But if you're a tunneling company and you know that there's only going to be 7 major tunneling projects in the United States the next 10 years, why bother? It's not efficient to try to lower the cost. But if you think that if we lower to 10% the cost, we think we might have 100 drilling projects the next year, then it makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I have a question about the Boring Company, and I don't know what I don't know what the right answer I'm looking for, but I'm posing this as a prompt. We talked about the Boring Company and creating this railway system would be privately funded. How do you feel about basically a layer of transportation being publicly owned or being privately owned? And owning that much space?
You know, one of the ways, I don't know what the particular legalities of how they do it, but one way to make it work is that that you say, we're going to dig a tunnel under your streets. We're going to do this. Mm-hmm. The city's going to own it, and we're going to buy a lease for 40 years to be able to operate this. You know, that's one of the ways we handle this traditionally, is that a lot of quote public transportation is actually public mandated, but then a privately held company or a company that's outside not under direct city control, but the city may own a partnership of it, or the city owns the infrastructure that it's using or whatever. And I think that you want to have checks and balances there, because you don't want to give somebody permission to build these tunnels, then one day Elon Musk like, all right, it's $1,000 a person, you know, like It's a valid question. So I think the safe way might be have the city owns the tunnels and leases them back to them.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a great new layer of public infrastructure and mass transit, but they're also I haven't seen this full talk, and I don't know everything about the Boring Company, but that would be something that I'd like to see at least generally addressed.
Yep.
In terms of this checks and balances.
Yeah, you don't want it to be a transfer of wealth that's not compensated. You don't want to all of a sudden say, oh, you've got a great idea, now we're going to give you, you know, the all the rights to all the roads and all this sort of stuff, because that creates a monopoly. And I would bet that Elon Musk would agree with that, and also say that, hey, we want other people creating loops, and let's make sure they can all connect up to each other.
Right.
But let's create a network like the internet of all this high speed connectivity, you know, and let other parties come and play. He's encouraged that to a degree with Hyperloop.
Because back home in Virginia, we had or do have a light. We have a small light rail, and there is a big kerfuffle when it was built in one city, and it reached the boundary of another city, and the other city had to decide: well, are we going to continue building that one road, or are we going to make our own rail and then have them have some sort of transfer station? Now that's partially because it's cities have their own governments there, but you wouldn't want three Hyperloop or three of these boring company systems duplicating each other's spaces, you know.
I think But that's, I think, part of the benefit of the technology that they're pitching is that you can just have tunnels under tunnels under tunnels, and you can have a better solution for things like that, even if cities can't come to an agreement on where something should be. Theoretically, you could have another one that is distinct and separate from it while getting the same result, right? Like, you would have to agree on exits, but there wouldn't. You wouldn't necessarily have to have all the expense of creating and earmarking money for another version of it.
Yeah. You know, the one of the things to think about the upside of this is people go, oh, it's a subway. These loops, basically, they're underground roads. The vehicles that transport on them use these electric sort of platform skids that run on a road. So you could have that connect to that thing could go up to another surface road and go into another one that somebody else. I can't connect my subway train to another train track without having to build track and build this and do cooperation right away. Although it's very complicated. If it's a different gauge, it changes everything. High speed rail only works a certain kind of rail, whatever. But if you're basically just sending electric vehicles through tunnels, you can put those electric vehicles through any tunnel, you know? And that's kind of the beauty of it is somebody else said, we're going to build our own thing. What's going to be different? Well, we're going to have a larger diameter. Okay. We can still run ours. You know, we can still, a vehicle can go through mine and we can connect up to yours because you're in the next county and we're going to go seamlessly through there and a computer will keep track of mileage and figure out how we charge it or whatever.
Hmm. Yeah. It's fascinating. It'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. It's so weird because this is still emerging developments in a space where this sort of change either doesn't come at all or comes very slowly. You know, I don't know when we would start to see the benefits of a system like this just based on how long it would take to construct even the first usable tunnels.
I don't think the longest part of the process is going to be the tunneling. I think it's going to be the bureaucratic layer.
History would say that is always the longest phase.
Yeah. And you know, they've already made a lot of progress. Like they've shown the video of the tunnel they've already dug and they made mad crazy progress. And I think that they're still in the process. They're building, like they're working on, they have three different tunneling machines. They have the one they have now, which is just one that they've a modified one and then kind of a hybrid one. Then they have a third stage one that they're trying to work on and, you know, improve the tech. But also it's like when they started this company, they knew nothing about what processes, what everything you had to go through, permitting and all that. And they said, well, let's just find out. Let's go to LA. We want to build a tunnel. What do we need to do?
So naive. So you're the LA, you're our resident LA expert, Andrew. Did you see this what if diagram of the tunneling system?
What that is it's just an example of what they, you know, like a starting point idea of what they want to do. And so this is a tunnel that goes from down below like LAX airport all the way up to Sherman Oaks. And to give you an idea of what's in between here is that it goes up through Hollywood, everything like that. And there's a mountain range in between there where there's two choke points there, the 405 and whatnot. It doesn't go far enough east to make me happy where I am out there in the valley in Burbank. But man, again, the plan is it's not like, and this is it. It's like, hey, here's an example of how we can connect these different parts of the city and how quickly you can get from point A to point B. And I think they may have chosen part of the example, just, you know, these are big traffic points from there. So, it's kind of amazing because when you look at this, it seems like Harry Potter magic, yeah. You know? It's like an port key, you know, the idea that, well, I'm going to walk in this tunnel and get here. Like, I think about, man, I should go do the subway here. And then I look at, like, how long it takes would take to get from the subway closest to, if I'm already at the subway closest to me to downtown, I'm like, I'm just going to drive. I'm just going to drive. It's not saving me. It's taking me longer, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so, that would be, it would be life changing.
So for example, they had the LAX to Dodger Stadium, right? That is, according to Google, 19.9 miles away from each other. And if you were to try to get, you landed in LAX and you wanted to get to presumably a 7 p.m. Dodger game for first pitch, and you're leaving at 5 o'clock, that takes anywhere between 50 to an hour and 50 minutes, depending on, you know, traffic and any accidents that might befall you, according to Google's data, right?
And one of the things to think about too, what the loop does, because it's so much cheaper, is there would be a loop at the end of your airport terminal. Mm-hmm. Okay. The idea that you would just go to your terminal, they have a photo, by the way, there's like the last photo in the slide deck, where they show, you know, like the idea of like LAX, but the idea is you could just go to the end of your terminal. You could hop into a loop station and be away rather than try to get to the end of my terminal, go through everything else, go through this, all this. And it's just, once you just dramatically lower the cost, you know, it becomes, you know, an amazing possibility. And it's just, you know, it's not so much, it's not a technology problem. It's changing the way we think about things.
Yeah. Oh God, look at this. This is like, it looks like Tron.
Yeah. So we're looking at this interior bay area where people are walking towards and boarding these cars that are behind these high glass partitions. And it says LAX, and then you hop into one and then whisks you away.
Wow.
Into an ingoing and outgoing tunnel.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, but Elon Musk says in a few months, they hope to have the test tunnel open. He says he's invite the public to go there. He's like, oh, it's cool. It'd be like a Disneyland ride right in the middle of LA.
Without the view, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, very cool.
I hope it happens. I hope that, you know, the frustrating part is there are legitimate concerns for this. There are legitimate concerns. And, you know, Bryce brought up one about, like, when you turn over something like this completely to a private enterprise, but again, most public transportation is run by some aspect of that. How do we make sure that we're not giving up too much? Mm-hmm. How do we make these things interoperable? How do we make sure that we don't, you know, create a system that becomes too complicated? But the other part that gets frustrating, though, is that, you know, there was a Culver City meeting where, you know, this was brought up, and there was a representative there from the city council who was just, calling the hint, you know, like, this is harebrained. It's this, it's this. It's like, all right, that's a personal point of view, but I don't know if that's really the place to say this. Voice your concerns, you know, and if you have a particular view of how you think there's in mass transit, there are people that just think that we should be spend longer to get where we want to go and share a vehicle with, you know, a bunch. You know, Elon Musk made a comment about like mass transit being scary or dangerous, and people are like, oh, how dare you? And it's like, I'm sorry. There are cities and there are places, there are transit lines where people are afraid to use at night. The people are afraid to use it certain times of day. That's a reality. We can pretend that's not the case, but that is the case. That is the reality. There are transit lines that have way higher instances of violence because they're unprotected. There's not much is done about this, you know. And to deny that and to say like, no, that's not true, is a falsehood. And so the idea of individualized private transport where you could use a smaller vehicle or whatever like this, you know, maybe not a bad idea. You know, I mean, it's just this, there's this utopian idea where we all get along, but there are predatory people and there's environments where people are hostile.
Well, and not to mention, these infrastructures are something that will continue to be attacked by innovation, even with the Uber and Lyft scenario. Like, as of now, with the Uber Pool Express, I can, for the price of walking a little bit to get picked up and walking a little bit to where I want to go, I can get pretty much anywhere in Oakland for $3 door to door.
Yeah. Wow. Right.
And to get across the bridge, it sometimes can be, you know, around like 9 or 10. It is $4 to do it on BART. So, and that's going to this static line. Like, we are going to continue to see, like, because those prices have fallen considerably as they've added new different ways to do it and connect riders. Like, we are rapidly getting to the point where in places that there are gigantic pools of people that want to use these services, that they're getting more cost effective. Now, does that mean we already have a tremendous amount of people that show up in the Bay Area from Sacramento and some of even as far as LA, because the bonuses up here in the Bay Area are bigger for super riders? We have more cars on the road. Like, so that creates its own kind of problem. But look, I'm all for, I like the BART. I think the BART's fine. I like the subway when I was living in New York City. Does it mean that it's working as well as it could? Does it mean that it is immune to the idea that it should be challenged by other solutions? No, I think that it should. Again, it gets back to this, the science thing we were talking about earlier, the worth of these solutions, specifically ones where we have our own money or our collective money going to it, or it's being run by our government, should be measured by how well it can fend off possible other solutions, and not that, well, we're stuck with it, so now let's pretend like it's the greatest thing ever.
You know, and thing I want to illustrate too is sort of what the magical grand vision of all of this is. The end goal is this. As Musk has said in so many tweets, you have the loop to get you around the city, right? You have the loop to get you around the city, point to point in a city. You build a bunch of loops underneath your city, which means we've just built cheaper tunnels that we can move things back and forth under a city. We have that. All of a sudden, you can get point to point anywhere in the city, 10, 15 minutes, wherever. It costs you $1 to do this. Then the loops connect to the Hyperloop. The Hyperloop is the tunnel where you suck all the air out of it so you can put a vehicle through there very, very fast and don't have to worry about wind resistance, right? So the Hyperloop is progressing more so than I thought would have been possible at this point. So then you have the Hyperloop that runs from LA to San Francisco, you know, San Francisco to Salt Lake, you know, Salt Lake to New Mexico to Austin to whatever. And you connect the Hyperloops up. So you can hop on a loop, get off, or hop up a loop, go to a Hyperloop station, and then go, maybe even go cross country by making four or five changes there. Go cross country faster than it would take you to fly in an airplane, you know, if your connections are quick enough. You know, like the Hyperloop would allow you to connect up large parts of the country, you know, through fast transit, you know, be able to go from back and forth there. Then the next stage, so crazy enough to have loop, to have Hyperloops even crazier. Then the idea that, like, hey, remember when they showed the big Falcon rocket, the idea that you could use this from point to point on planet Earth?
Yeah.
You hop in a loop or a Hyperloop station and it takes you to a BFR launch facility. Maybe it's under the ocean. Maybe you go there, you know, take tube transport out there. Maybe it's in the middle of the desert. Maybe we build a big launch facility somewhere in Mojave and we isolate the sound. Hop in a transport, you go there, you do one on the West Coast, you do one on the East Coast, you platforms, whatever. You're anywhere in the world in under an hour. And that's the goal, is this super connected world. You can get anywhere in your city in a few minutes. You could get anywhere in your state in under an hour, or anywhere in the country in just a couple hours. Or if you want to go global, anywhere in the world in an hour.
Yeah. And we talked a few weeks ago about Virgin Hyperloop, which might be dropping the Hyperloop branding, doing deals to do cargo Hyperloop for freight.
I went to, before they became Virgin, I went there and I visited them and I saw their presentations on this, and they were talking a bit about cargo. And I don't know that is the, at this point, like, if you where speed is the most important thing. And I could be wrong, but a lot of it's just logistics. And, you know, you get paid your most, like, I don't know that's – because I saw an example where they showed, like, oh, here's how we could offload. They showed this, like, this platform at sea where, like, they could have a – they could be loading cargo, taking cargo from a cargo ship and bringing it to a port without having the ship to go into port. And they're talking about using the Hyperloop for that. And I asked – I said – and it's – I'm like, what is the biggest choke point there? Is it how fast you can move the cargo from the ship to the port, or is it how fast you can unload the cargo from the ship? Because my understanding is the most time-consuming process is taking each container off and bringing it down there. You can have a train or you can have a trolley. You don't need a Hyperloop for that. You don't need a thing that moves 700 miles an hour, because nothing is unloading the ship at 700 miles an hour. And it kind of got this, yeah, you know, it's an application, whatever kind of thing. Like, I don't know. I don't know enough to know, but I know that, like, I don't know if that's the best use for it. So,
well, and it's my understanding is that this and in the parts of the world that they were planning on starting this, which looked like the Middle East, there are large tracts of land to be crossed where even if your input is a bottleneck, you would still be able to save time with long haul transport, I would think. But
yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't. Yeah, again, I mean, I'd be great. I mean, great if they can make that. They can make that happen. Yeah, I think that would be great. And you know, pipelines have done tremendous for oil, but the amount of volume of material trying to move oil, things like that, is tremendous. So could be. I don't know enough to know whether I got less excited about that. I mean, I like the idea of an all-purpose tunnel. You could put people through. You could put freight. You could put anything through. But I mean, personally, I mean, I'm more invested in the idea of, you know, how can I get around faster?
Sure.
Yeah.
Anyhow, gentlemen, do you want to do picks?
Sure. Absolutely.
I have a pick.
Sure, go ahead.
It's a documentary I watched over the weekend, Friday or Saturday, and I had seen the trailer for it, and okay, so my recommendation to watch this is not to try to sway anybody, because I don't think you would watch this and be swayed on the subject matter. But I do think that in all of the controversy around the subject, this at least shines a light on a dark corner that people don't know. So, Justin, you probably know the Rachel Dolezal controversy.
Indeed, yes. The woman who was in the leadership of a local NAACP or chapter, mm-hmm. and was revealed that she was indeed not black, despite a physical appearance that might have belayed that.
Right, she was
transracial.
Yes, and I think that story really spread the idea of just the word transracial. So Netflix has a documentary called The Racial Divide, which lays a very complicated patchwork of all of the things that happened before that story blow up and as it blows up, and her life today / last year or so, trying to, you know, provide for her kids and as well as like maintain dignity. I think that's the big thing that I took away from the Rachel Divide, is that what is motivating her has to be dignity. Because the story, and I, as someone who only tangentially heard about her whole ordeal, was the transracial thing. But the documentary goes on to show, well, the people who are around her are not upset about that immediately. They are upset about, they believe that she was lying about other things related to her work at the NAACP. And it even shows that there are people who believe her, or believe that there's both truth and falsehoods in that story. But also, it shows that probably the only reason that this story came to light was because she and her sister were suing their brother, and their parents sided with the brother and were running basically a counter ops, if you will, to discredit her and to discredit the two daughters, and in the course of that, bringing this to light, leaking it to the press, that story blowing up and growing larger and larger. It's complicated, and I think I don't think you will come out of this documentary agreeing with her decision to identify as transracial or to identify as black. But I do think it will let you empathize with the struggle that someone who has been a part of a national conversation on that level and continues to have to live in that nation as sort of being known as this person. It helps you empathize with the issues that you have to deal with. You know, I think she could come out and just one day say, you know what, as you are all right and I was wrong, and transracial is not a thing. And I'm sure that would make some people happy. But I think the reason that she doesn't is because that wouldn't solve anything. And I don't think that would change her life for the better.
Yeah.
But she would equally walk away with no dignity. That's an interesting viewpoint. It's an interesting.
I remember when the trailer for this came out, there was a conversation that I saw on Twitter that was very critical of it from a writer of a bio on her, that the movie, there had been, a concerted effort with a couple of people who had written magazine pieces to kind of keep her daughter, Rachel Dolezal's daughter, kind of out of the story, because it wasn't necessarily about her, and this is such a controversial topic, mm-hmm. that it felt unfair to, you know, even if Dolezal wanted the daughter to be a part of the story, to make a daughter the part of the story. And that seemed to be the difference in this documentary, was that it focused on her as a parent. Did you feel that the daughter was a central element of the story, if not exploited?
Do you mean her newborn daughter?
I haven't seen the movie. All I remember is a half-remembered Twitter conversation.
So I will say that part of the documentary is about her becoming pregnant and having giving birth to a child. And so facet of it is, you know, what do you write on the birth certificate, you know? But there is a good talk about her two sons, her adopted son and her biologic son. If there's another daughter,
No. It might have been a son.
It talks a little bit about the sons. I think it tries to respect their boundaries. Her younger son definitely says in an interview, "Well, there are definitely things I don't like, and definitely things that I am not talking about and won't talk about," and it's left at that. But that is only one smaller facet of the documentary.
Yeah. Look, I think she's a very problematic person in the center of a very, problematic debate. In summation, I am very grateful that she exists, because she was the subject of one of the funniest lines in those new Dave Chappelle specials, which, always great dealing with racial conversations.
Yeah.
I only saw the trailer and I would say the power of the trailer was that there were a couple of black women that were talking to her when she was doing a dress, and they were bringing up, you got a very, very succinct, point from them about, hey, you don't understand what's like to grow up with, to look in a culture where it doesn't reflect you or doesn't reflect something that's familiar to you or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's so much of what makes them part of who they are. And I remember what seemed like, that's a great example, because it's like, we only know our own experiences. We only know our own experiences, and we can put ourselves and try to put ourselves in the frame of mind of somebody else. But, I'm a 6'2" guy. And I don't know what it's like to walk down the street, and I feel maybe vulnerable in some situations, but I don't know what it's like to feel a lot more vulnerable, and maybe I should, but I don't know what that's like at some points, sure. I have my own insecurities about something, but I don't know what it's like to deal with insecurities. The closest I've ever come to being like, the super outsider is like living in Japan. But, where people look at you weird, you walk in certain parts of town, people like, well, this is kind of, who are you? What are you? But I go home. That's not what I grew up with. So, right.
And I think the documentary does two good things on that point, Andrew, in that it equally succinctly lays out that exact argument that that the idea of being transracial does not exist in a vacuum. You have to deal with the history of the country. Mm-hmm. And the current state of racial politics in America, and you have some sort of, for lack of a better word, a parachute, should you want that. I think it also talks about her very rough upbringing, and and I don't think that she's shown, and maybe this is where there's a bias in how she's portrayed, but I don't think she's shown as trying to take advantage of this identity. But that's something where
that is the most sympathetic that I've felt for her, is that like the world found her. Mm-hmm. She, I mean, where is it in, is it spoke? Where is it? Somewhere in the middle of the country, right?
It's Washington, I think.
Oh, is it Spokane or something?
I believe it's, that sounds right. Spokane, Washington.
Okay. So like she was doing this job, and unless I've missed something in the coverage, she wasn't looting it, right? And she was, it seemed to be a competent part of that management structure, that people weren't furious with her. The world found her and had this conversation using her as the example. Now, I think her behavior going past that is something that you can raise red flags about, but also, hell, what happens when the world swoops down and decides you're now an international topic of conversation? You know, it's kind of crazy. So that's the one part that I've always looked at. Like, you know, if this never happened and she just went and lived her entire life doing exactly what you'd done before and exactly a version of that going forward, she would have just been known as somebody who'd lived this life. Right? It wouldn't have been a thing, but the universe had other ideas.
Yeah. I would just cautiously add one more thought too, on the subject of kind of identity politics and that sort of topic, is that one of the things that I think that often gets left out though is that we're very quick to put things into racial, but then we sort of ignore economic divides. And sometimes we conflate one thing when really it's about something else or whatever, you know. I was born in Opelika, Alabama. You know, I could describe myself as a cracker. I could describe myself as being this, you know, part of this redneck that sometimes that the left coast, you know, like to make fun of or whatever like this. But I wasn't born poor. I wasn't born in that environment. I come from upper middle class family. My parents are from the north, and I'm not. I could very easily take this moniker on because, like, oh, well, when they make fun of, you know, rednecks and things like this, it's, you know, making fun of me. But not really making fun of me. It's making fun of people who are come from a poor background or whatever like this. And I think sometimes in these identity politics is people want to take on these labels because, hey, I can now identify with this group. But I'm not really the same thing as this group. You know, I had friends and, you know, Justin and I grew up in South Florida, and you had very, very multicultural group, and you realized the differences weren't just racial. It was, were you from the north? You're from the south, you know, which you could be Hispanic, but my God, you try to conflate all Hispanic people together into one group. Don't work. The differences are huge. And I think that, you know, and I think that's part of, I think sometimes the appeal for people is like, I'm gonna put this label on me because I nominally fit this label. But even though you don't share those experiences with a lot of people from there. So, you know, I grew up in an upper middle class environment, and, you know, I can, you know, if somebody makes a redneck joke, I'm like, well, you know, I was born in Alabama. Like, oh, you know, it's like, I don't care, but I'm not really, I don't share that experience.
Yeah. So. Hey guys, guess what? I just showed up. I made it just in time for the beginning of the show, right?
Yeah.
We're just about to start.
All right, Brian, what's your pick?
Oh, we're on to picks. Oh, doggone it. My pick is, what was the name of that card game that I had open on the desktop?
Strip Poker.
Oh, I don't remember. You were telling me about it this weekend.
Yeah.
But I don't remember the name of it.
Starts with a P.
Okay. Well, I'm going to type in fight, P.
Patreon.com, my favorite card
probably
game.
Not.
Yeah.
Pornhub, what's that?
No, if you search a type of Hearthstone StarCraft card game. Yeah,
this
there you go.
This is going great. Should Blizzard make a StarCraft card game?
It's the,
Hearthstone. Is it Hearthstone?
PC game. Prismata. There it is.
Prismata.
Nailed it. Yeah. So it's billed, according to PC Gamer, they said the best parts of StarCraft and Hearthstone. It's kind of a real-time strategy sort of game played with cards, cards that attack other cards. It's delightful and kind of hypnotic, and I really enjoyed it. It's only 20-something bucks. And it's got a campaign mode filled with a bunch of kind of JRPG-style storytelling elements where characters pop onto screen and text says their thing, and then they jump off screen so someone else can jump on screen to tell you what to be afraid of.
Brian, I'm going to be that guy. This is a card game in the way that you read audiobooks.
Yeah. Wait, what do you mean?
I mean, this is the world has changed around me too quickly that you have a card game that's purely electronic.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, of course. I mean, okay, yeah, it's a card game. Yes, but also I've become accustomed to the idea of reading audiobooks for a long time. it's fun. That's Prismata neat. Is a blast.
It's on PC?
Yeah, it's on PC. I'm surprised. It looks from the format of it that it's just begging to be adapted to mobile devices of all varieties. But
oh, this was a Kickstarter.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
Interesting. Very cool.
And what's great is like because it's turn-based, when you're playing against a computer, you can realize you're screwed and you could just back up however many turns to get back to a place where you felt like maybe you had a chance of winning.
That's cool.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Justin, you have a pick?
Yeah, I like Deadpool 2. I thought it was, if you like Deadpool 1, man, you should go see Deadpool 2. A lot of those things that you liked are there, and, it's a lot of fun. I laughed a lot. I think that there are some larger questions that you can have in terms of, how much it makes you excited for further Deadpool adventures, and, there may be some kind of directions of where they took the franchise that you can have. But by and large, I don't think that anybody who liked Deadpool 1 can go into that movie and not walk out saying that they laughed for a large portion of it.
Yeah,
I would say that when the laughs hit hardest on Deadpool 2, they hit much harder than in Deadpool 1.
Oh, yeah. There are some huge
there's a lot of chuckles moments. In Deadpool 1. But yeah. The laughs that hit hard in 2, like full on guffawing. Moments.
It's really, really, really funny, and the acting is well done. There's a lot of faves from previous things we've mentioned, including Zazie Bates from Atlanta is great as Domino, and the young boy from Hunt for the Wilder People is great as a similarly foul-mouthed young man.
Cool.
Side note on the whole card game thing. Did you see there's a Patreon right now? This person's creating animated maps for tabletop RPGs.
Oh, that's great. So wait, the maps, do
like
they
for
use
Roll 20 or?
Let me just Gmail this to Bryce. Lest me say something stupid about tabletop gaming like this.
Okay. Cause there's like roll20.net, which will do digital tabletop. But
take a look here. I'm going to go see Deadpool today at 5:00. Looking forward to that. And I'm excited. Yeah. We'll pull up. What this is like, if you want to do your campaign and you want to have a really cool map to play it on top of, just take your flat screen screen off the wall, set it on the table.
Wait, that's great.
Plug it in. And now you've got your campaign map that's animated and you move your characters around.
Huh? That's interesting.
That's rad.
Yeah. Very cool. And again, what I like about this guy says, hey, I'll create these maps and make it easier to do the campaigns, which is cool. And we can see where this is going to go. You know, when we start getting augmented reality or, you know, our interactive flat screens like the Microsoft Surface, but cheaper that you can put on a table, you know, there is this, if there's anything that I've observed in the last 5 years is how much we really like to have the old school, we like to interact with the sort of the old school media.
Hmm. Hell yeah.
Cool. Did you have a pick, Andrew?
My pick. Sorry, I was muting myself there. My pick is I've decided that I wanted to like read more. You know, I wanted to read more. And the problem is when I go into the restroom or the bathroom, I would like, you know, bring my iPad, bring my iPhone, whatever. And I would just start surfing the web, surfing the news, visit the Reddit SpaceX or SpaceX Lounge page over and over and over and over and again. And I'm like, I'm not reading enough books. And I, like Brian, I love audiobooks. Audiobooks have become my primary way to consume stuff. But I also like to make fun of Brian when he calls it reading, even though I feel the same way. But it's just, it is the hypocrisy that is Maine. But I wanted to read more. And I'm like, well, what's the problem? Like, I do lack self-control. I said, what if I tried to limit? And I have like a really cool one of the Paperwhite Kindles or the odd. I have a Kindle Oasis, whatever. But like I like a bigger sort of screen or whatever. So I did what anybody who lacks self-control does, is I impulse bought something else to solve this problem for me. And I would say in the last 4 days, 5 days, it has helped considerably. And that is, I just bought myself a cheap Kindle Fire tablet, right? So I got the Fire HD, which is great. These things are only like $150, right? And I have next to me, I have an iPad Pro, which is amazing. It's super. It's awesome. I use this, which is really, really great. But I wanted something that was just a little bit easier to just port around and not care about. So I've been using this with my books and stuff on there. And again, people are like, great, Andrew, you've discovered something that everybody else knows about and uses. But the purpose of which was I wanted to, you know, wanted to have a way in which I could just focus purely on writing or reading rather. And so, you know, that's what I did. So, you know, and I could sit there and I can read my beginner's guide, graphic statistics guides and things like this and stuff. So it's been very helpful.
It's funny. You would think that going with a cheaper version of a thing would make you value it less. But to my astonishment, it just owns its own category where it becomes adorable that it's like, oh, this is the cheap one that's dedicated just to this one thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't put apps on here. You know, I don't have games or things on there. Like I could watch my Netflix or my Amazon Prime on there, but I've got devices for that. So if I take this into the restroom, it's already open on the book. It's already open on that page. It's there to do one thing, you know, to have me read books. So, and you can get, they have the Kindle. What's the beautiful thing is the hardware now. Like I had one of the first ones they put out there and it was okay, but you know, it was still, the screen display wasn't, you could see the huge difference between that and an iPad. You picked up an iPad like, oh my God, this is from the future. This is from the 60s. Now, like, it's good enough. It's good enough. $150 device has two cameras. It has, not that I want to use them. The display, the dots per inch on it is exceptionally good. Doesn't cause any eye strain yet. It's not like you're looking at a bunch of lines, which the first ones did. So I think that like the cheap things now are really good enough.
Okay.
So
do you have the 10-inch one?
Yeah, this is the 10-inch.
Cool.
So, and I like the form factor too. Actually, for reading, it's you know, easier I think to hold. So anyhow, that's a thought. If you're looking to focus your time and what you're trying to do, think about you could take a device you already have and say, okay, I'm going to take this iPad or my tablet, my Google tablet or whatever, and I'm going to strip off everything except for Kindle or Google Play Books or whatever, and you'd be surprised that, you know, making it less easy just to click over and no notifications. Wonderful. You know, get rid of Facebook and Twitter on this, no notifications on it, and you're doing the thing you want to do.
Cool.
So
awesome.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.